Go ahead.
May it please the court, Ron Holliger for the Department of Corrections. This court should grant the defendant a new trial for error in the verdict directing instruction. Alternatively, if the court disagrees, it should remand to the trial court for recalculation of the punitive damage cap and not include attorney's fees in the amount subject to the cap's multiplier. Before, I'm going to talk first about the verdict director that was given in this disability discrimination case, and it requires some recitation, at least very brief, of the facts and the MHR's method of treating disability claims. Disability under the MHRA has a technical meaning. It's not disability as commonly understood by laymen. One may have an undisputed physical or mental impairment and not be disabled for purposes of the MHRA. The MHRA does not guarantee employment for or freedom from discrimination in employment to anyone having an impairment. What it does is it protects two classes of people, those who have an impairment that doesn't prevent them at all from doing their job. They can do all the full duties of the job despite the impairment, so they can't be treated differently or not hired because they have some impairment. They can do the job. And secondly, it protects those who have an impairment but can perform all of the duties of the job if they are given some reasonable accommodation. So again, they must be able to perform all the duties of the job under either scenario, but with some reasonable accommodation. Those who can't perform all of the duties of the job are given no protection under the MHRA if they can't perform the job after being given that accommodation. Whether Mrs. Hervey was disabled was the essential factual dispute in this case. Both sides presented contested evidence as to whether she could fully perform, even given accommodation. There was evidence presented by the plaintiff that she could perform if they would give her accommodations. Actually, the evidence would show there were a number of accommodations that were made, a string of them over a number of months. From the defendant's side, there was evidence that they gave many, many accommodations, and despite those, she never was able to perform all the duties of the job, the classic factual dispute. But that dispute was not submitted to the jury for its determination. There are two fundamental principles, or there are actually more, but the two that are most important here in jury instructions are these. The first is that the jury instruction must accurately state the law. The second is the jury instruction must be a complete statement of the law. Now, the parties agree on those principles, but we have some differences as to how we apply them. But let me go into a little more specifics about what the parties do agree on. The parties agree that disability is a fact issue in an MHR disability discrimination claim. Defendants don't dispute that's a fact issue, and there are several cases cited in the briefs that say that is a predicate fact in a disability discrimination case. Also, the parties don't disagree that MAI 3124 does not include a predicate finding of disability. Parties also agree that the law is clear that all contested fact issues must be submitted to the jury. And fourth, it's error for jury instruction not to accurately state the law. We also agree that prejudice is presumed if an applicable MAI instruction is not given. And we also agree that the state properly preserved its objection to the verdict director. It's DOC's suggestion that if the court properly applies all these principles, that this situation isn't particularly complicated.
Does the record show why the trial court, that this objection was raised, that the issue of disability needed to be submitted, but the court chose not to because of the MAI?
Because there was a model MAI. One of the cardinal principles of MAI is that, besides the ones I already mentioned, is that an MAI should be modified if the law is changed. It should be modified if one of the usual elements is not contested.
Can I ask you?
Yes, Judge.
You know, in the second instruction,
that was given to the jury. The word disability is there. Disability was a contributing factor in such discharge. Do you recall from the record how was that argued by plaintiff or defendant to the jury that disability was required under that instruction?
I do know that the plaintiff argued that disability was clear. In effect, I think making an argument that there was no issue as to disability, it was just obvious that she was disabled. I think that the defendant argued that she wasn't disabled. But I also think that an argument to a jury can't cure a misstatement of the law.
Well, I'm not sure this is a misstatement of the law as much as it is. In the first charge, it's defendant discharged plaintiff. Then disability was a contributing factor. Now, disability, there is no requirement that disability be linked to plaintiff specifically or expressly, let me say.
That's one of the arguments.
But isn't that the way you would infer that when you heard that as a jury? And if it was argued to you, what I'm getting at is prejudice. How are you prejudiced if the words there, the only likely interpretation is that plaintiff has to be disabled, that's argued to the jury, and the jury comes back?
Well, the defendant's argument is that it doesn't refer to plaintiff's disability, and that's why it's not error. Yeah. That it refers to some hypothetical disability of some hypothetical person.
Or maybe other people discharging her.
Now, the other thing about that is...
What's the general rule regarding when terms need to be defined under MAI?
The rule is, first of all, that all terms for which there's a definition in MAI have to be defined. Then the secondary rule is that terms which have technical meaning may be defined in the discretion of the trial court. But that's a discretionary call if there's not a mandatory definition listed in MAI. Judge, going back to your question, I would think it's equally inferable, and I think it's a first principle that we all have to apply when looking at juries and looking at instructions. We have to assume, if we're going to have any belief in the system, that they follow the instructions.
Yeah, but what are they going to follow that?
And if the instruction does not require them to find something...
How are they going to hear that number second? Can you give me a way that they would look at that other than thinking the disability is plaintiff's disability?
I think they would think just what the plaintiff argued, disability is clear here, and think that they don't have to find...
Oh, that it's assumed.
That he's disabled, she was disabled.
What was the definition of disability given? So,
it was given in instruction, I think it was the next instruction. Now, one thing I think that weighs somewhat against tying that as to helping somewhat is it's not even a proper definitional instruction. A definitional instruction either has to be attached to the bottom of the verdict director, or it has to cross-reference the verdict director.
There was no cross-reference.
There was no cross-reference here, and in fact, that was one of the objections that the state made, is it should have cross-referenced, if it was going to be given at all, it should have cross-referenced to the verdict director. So at least the jury was told those had some relationship to each other.
So you think MAI 3124 applies in a situation where disability is not in dispute, and that when there is a dispute about disability, then a modified version of MAI 3124 has to be used.
That's exactly our argument. There are legions of other situations in MAI that are identical in the master-servant relationship, in an automobile accident where there's a suit against the driver and the employer. If agency is not an issue, you don't have to submit it. If there's no argument about whether the employee was in the course and scope of their employment, you don't have to submit it. However, if it is an issue, then you have to take the language out of Chapter 13 of MAI, apply it to 1701 or 1702 to make it an issue that the jury would make a finding on. Here we have kind of an unusual situation, probably not foreseen. This one instruction was drafted to cover race, sex, national origin, and discrimination claims. I can conceive of very few situations where race would ever be a factual issue, or where sex would be a factual issue, or where national origin would be a factual issue. So the it's not required to have that as a submission if it isn't an issue. Actually, the case most on point to this case is Cox versus J.C. Penney. And that was a case written by Judge Robertson of this court after the adoption of comparative fault in Missouri. Prior to comparative fault, there was a requirement in the MAI instruction on premises liability that the plaintiff didn't know of the condition, so that it was, if it was an open and obvious condition, the plaintiff loses. Contributory negligence, in effect. And the plaintiff had to almost disprove contributory negligence because they had to show that they were not aware of and could not have been aware of the defect. In Cox, that was the instruction that was given to the jury because it was the MAI instruction, word for word. This court held that was wrong, even though that was an MAI instruction. It was a misstatement of the law because the law had changed. With comparative fault, that was not part of the plaintiff's burden anymore. And the court reversed, even though it was a form MAI instruction. There are many cases that say, you've got to follow the MAI instruction unless it's wrong. And in this case, it was a misstatement of the law.
Now, you're saying that the disability as defined in instruction 6 is an erroneous statement of law? Or are you just saying it was in
the
wrong
place? Well, we made an objection to the definition, but I don't think that the definition itself is necessarily, and we don't question that now at this point.
Right. At this point, the argument is whether or not it was really required to be in the verdict director as opposed in a separate instruction that just...
Well, it could have been a separate instruction if...
If they cross-referenced it.
It might have been if they cross-referenced. Right. I don't think even then, because there's no place in that instruction that says to the jury, you've got to find that she's disabled before you can find for her. I'm going to assume, and I'd like to be able to assume, that the jury is going to disregard the instructions and go out and start making up its own things and its own factual determinations that the court has not told it are important.
Any more questions at this time? Thank you, Mr. Oliver.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court. I feel a little sandbagged here this morning, but not by my opponent. When Chip told me that he couldn't argue this case, he told me that he had something to do in Mississippi, but I now realize he just didn't want to listen to all that criticism of Adams versus Children's Mercy. Your Honor, for the first 6 years out of law school, I thought surely that jury instructions must be subject to some series of spells and incantations because they appeared to be difficult for the regular lawyer to understand. And I think that whatever else comes out of this case, it would be good if there was some clarity about instructions. I think the issue that they have with the instruction is difficult to frame properly, but here is our analysis. The rule requires that the MAI instruction be given, and it's error not to give the MAI instruction. And the argument that they make is apparently, and maybe I didn't understand it when I read through their brief, is that they should have modified it to include a finding of disability. And Judge Holliger was right when he says that there are different levels of impairment and different findings under MHRA. One of them is perceptual. I am disabled. I have an insulin pump. It's not something you can see because it's underneath my clothes. But if you perceived me to have a disability and you treated me differently, then that would be a problem. The reason the MAI committee drafted this instruction in the way it did was to make it simple and clear. If you look at all of these cases that find assumed facts, you'll find a word that I had a lot of fun arguing about in Burns versus Smith, which is and. You will find that and in there because it adds to and assumes facts that should have been submitted separately in separate verdict directives. Here, if you take the definitional instruction, which was instruction number 6, and it says a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more of a person's major life activities, which with or without accommodation does not interfere with performing the job, and you use that with was a contributing factor in discharge, it's all a jury needed to find. I don't know how a jury could have been confused.
But Mr. Hollinger's point, which he clearly makes in his brief, is that the word, you can interpret the instruction to assume that the person has the disability, which it then goes on to define, and say, is that the reason for the discharge, rather than submitting separately. You have to first find, were they disabled? Did they have this kind of physical situation, or were they perceived to? And if so, then was that the reason for their discharge?
And I understand that argument.
And the law is clear that if MAI is not accurate, then you have to modify it.
That is correct.
Okay.
But the law is also, that's another one of the problems, frankly, with MAI. It says don't modify this, but then it's okay to modify. The instructions are sometimes very difficult to follow.
Counsel, let me ask you the
yes,
question
sir.
This way. Their instruction B that they offered, which they say the court should have granted their way of preserving this objection, do you agree that, I'm not asking you to agree that the way you submitted it was prejudicial, but do you agree that the way they submitted it would have been a permissible modification under the facts as tried in this case?
I don't have their instruction D in front of me, Your Honor.
They just start off with second comma, plaintiff is disabled as defined instruction number such and such. So rather than, basically they've used the cross-reference method of MAI as opposed to the inserting it at the bottom method.
I think that would have been perhaps permissible, but you know, you get into a lot of mischief when you start modifying MAI 3124. Prejudice is presumed if you mm-hmm. make an improvident, and if you look at their affirmative converse instruction 9, mm-hmm. one of the things you'll notice there is one of the problems you have with modifying MAI instructions. If you look at that, it talks about her complaint of disability discrimination, which again assumes that she made a complaint of disability discrimination as opposed to, and it essentially assumes a fact. And I believe it would have been error to give that for certain. But it looks to me like given that instruction, which was given, and instruction 8, a jury could not have been confused. Unlike the cases they cite where the jury came out with a jury question or you know asked for a conference with the judge about something, that didn't happen here. And the argument was certainly clear enough during the closing argument that they knew that disability was an issue that they had to decide. That gets back to what Judge Price asked earlier. There really just is no prejudice here because the jury was adequately instructed that the issue of disability was on the table. If you look through our brief in point one, I think you can see that fairly clearly. The argument is given in brief form with regard to what each side said about the issue of disability.
What does the record show about why instruction B was refused then? I mean, if both sides agree to it, then there's no presumed prejudice.
Your Honor, I was not at trial.
Okay.
I do not know. I'm strictly an appellate lawyer, and I don't have that answer. But while I agree, I don't necessarily think the judge would have agreed because he was trying to do what we tell judges to do, or what you tell judges to do, which is stick with the MAI, and the MAI is safe, and you'll be okay if you do it. And I don't think this is like agency because. I think Judge Hollinger's right when he says that there are some things that are not going to be necessary to be proved. But certainly disability discrimination and religious discrimination are not always obvious either when they are when you're judged on those things or when you're the person, you know, hiding behind that bias.
Going forward, we shouldn't change the instruction to include that paragraph.
I do not believe you should. I think the finding that's required here is disability was a contributing factor.
Well, disability is in with race and those other factors right within the MAI approved
right.
instruction. So they didn't ferret it out. They just allowed for a definition. So aren't we really arguing about whether or not there's prejudice by the failure to cross-reference it?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And the other thing I would point out is that the prejudice argument that the state makes, they did not make until their reply brief. Smith versus Brown and Williamson says if you don't make it in your original brief, it's waived.
Do you concede that disability was a contested fact in this case?
I do, Your Honor. And I concede also that that instruction required them to find it. Because if you read that instruction to include the definition, it requires that they find there was a physical or mental impairment.
Isn't there a prohibition to having multiple facts in one required finding? Am I mistaken? I thought.
No, I think that's like I said, I think that's where you get in trouble is where you start adding ands in there mm-hmm. in one paragraph. Here it says disability was a contributing factor.
So they would have to have both found the person was disabled and that disability was a contributing factor in number three.
Well, disability is a defined term. So they find that the person is disabled and that was the contributing factor. I mean, I understand the question that you're asking. But again, the real issue is whether or not there's prejudice, and I just don't think you can show prejudice when you can include that with their affirmative converse. This presented the issues to the jury. There's no evidence from any of the questions that the jury was confused or misled in any way in this case. And I think if you read through the factual statement, you read through the factual statement in both briefs, you get an appreciation for how much evidence there was about the presence of this disability and whether or not it needed to be accommodated. And at the end of the day, the issue was simply whether she was disabled. That was very well argued at the closing argument. Now, Judge Holliger makes the point that he doesn't think that closing argument can cure a defect in the instruction. And perhaps there is a way to write this instruction better going forward. But I don't believe you need to take away the jury verdict in this case because of it, because the evidence is they weren't prejudiced, and we used the MAI instruction just the way it is. As we pointed out in the brief, the A in approved instructions means you guys looked at it and said it was okay at least once.
For prejudice to occur, don't we have to find that the error materially affected the outcome of the case?
I think that is exactly what you have to find, Your
and
Honor.
Didn't that occur here?
I don't believe it did, Your Honor, not when you consider the instruction packet as a whole, because the disability issue was brought to the jury both in the instruction 8 and in the affirmative converse. And they made the point in their affirmative converse that there was no disability, it was merely a complaint of disability discrimination. So to me, if I'm sitting on that jury, I look at this and say, I have to determine whether or not this lady was disabled or not.
Is it a fair argument to say you can look at this instruction as a juror and say that disability is defined so that we know what disability is, but the disability here is assumed and the only thing submitted to us in the second charge is was it a contributing factor? It doesn't ask me to find that plaintiff was disabled. It just said this is what disability is. Was that a factor? And that is assumed.
I think linguistically there may be other ways to phrase this that would add or perhaps subtract from the clarity, but I don't believe that it assumes the fact. As we pointed out, it doesn't say plaintiff's disability, it says disability. Disability is clearly an issue here. And I don't see, first of all, they didn't show any prejudice in their brief. And I don't believe they can show prejudice now when you consider all of the instructions as a packet. And that is, I think, the chief argument. And if I have just a moment, I would touch on the punitive damages issue. I think that could certainly benefit from some clarity, too, from this court. It looks to me that the punitive damages calculation doesn't define, as they point out, what it is that's supposed to be subtracted, but really the only thing that makes sense is the punitive damage judgment itself. And certainly, there's nothing in the text of the statute that suggests that attorney's fees should be the one thing that's withdrawn. Not, you know. Plus, I would also point out, and this is sort of an interesting thought, the state is the only defendant that will ever appear in front of this court that already has a 50% discount on punitive damages. And as a result, one of the arguments they make is only the stuff that goes to the plaintiff should affect it. Well, then it becomes ultimately recursive, and you're already getting quite a bit of a discount as it is. I think the best answer on the punitive damages is that you subtract out the punitive damages awarded by the jury, and you make the judgment based on that. And I think we've presented that fairly clearly in the brief.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I don't need to use up the full time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you,
that.
Your Honor.
I'll just respond quickly because I noticed the bemused look on the court's face. It has not been decided, but actually we are facing arguments that it is unfair and not proper for the state as a wrongdoer to also take 50% of the punitive damage credit. So that's an issue still to be decided. MAI presumes that the parties in the court will put on their thinking caps when they're instructing a jury. It's not a simple mechanical process of stringing together a number of instructions, not using analysis and...
I understand that argument, Mr. Holligan. Let me ask you a question, because of the types of things that would be defined like disability, if you look in there, well, if it was race, if that was obvious, you wouldn't expect that to have to be defined.
No, it wouldn't have to be defined.
What about religion? Would you expect that to be defined? Or national origin? Those are things that maybe don't necessarily appear at first blush. How many of these things do you think would actually have to be defined?
I think that might be under the facts of a particular case. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say there could never be a situation. It's probably far less likely than it would be with discrimination.
Let me get back to race, though. Is it a perception versus the reality? For example, the President of the United States is a mixed race, but if he's perceived to be an African American and he's discriminated against because he's African American, that would fit into this situation.
Well, not as far as the MHR is concerned, unless... of course, you can't do this. It's a political process. Unless he was not elected or he was removed from office because of his race.
It's an employment statute.
Yes, it's an employment statute that we're dealing with here.
Your
Honor, I hesitated to use because I didn't want to be clumsy, but the employment lawyers in the office tell me that the classic example to help distinguish this is the blind airline pilot.
The who?
The blind airline pilot.
I've been wanting to fly for a long time.
Okay. Well, great. But
we're over-regulated.
That would be where your disability would affect your ability to pursue.
To do the job.
To the job.
And it would not be easy to accommodate.
Jordy LaForge, that's all I'm going to say.
Pardon?
Jordy LaForge is all I'm going to say.
With regard to the cap... you know, we both cited a bunch of cases. I don't think any of those provide you of any use. Net judgment is not the type of term that has some plain and ordinary meaning. So all these cases both of us cite, they don't help a bit. I think all you can do is look at the context of the statute and see whether including attorney's fees would be consistent with the context and the purpose of the statute.
Well, doesn't the statute, unlike the common law, make attorney's fees an element of damages, which it's not?
The MHRA does, but it is the only one. So actually, in this instance, a plaintiff with an MHRA claim is going to be treated better than somebody with a tort claim.
Well, they don't normally get attorney's fees as a tort claim.
No, they pay them out of their award.
Right.
And one of the arguments we've made, that in effect is what happens here. Because in many cases, I don't know about the fee arrangement in this particular case, but all of them I've seen are a contingency arrangement. And regardless of the fact that attorney's fees are awarded in a certain amount, that's not what the plaintiff pays his attorney. He pays a percentage. Let me give you an example.
Well, in Title VII cases, their attorney, it's a... it's a judgment being made by the legislature that these cases need to be brought, and this private attorney general.
Oh, and I don't disagree with that. I mean, the question is whether the legislature intended that those attorney's fees would be multiplied times five times to make the attorney's fee cap. An example, $1,000 in actual damages, five in punitive damage gives them of whatever amount, five times that would be $5,000. $1,000 in actual damages, $200,000 in attorney's fees, which is perfectly proper because some claims need to be brought. And that's the only way they can be brought, is by doing those. But then you multiply it times five, and suddenly the plaintiff is recovering $1.2 million or something like that on $1,000 worth of damages, even though actual damages, even though there's a 5% cap.
Or up to $500,000. Right. But, Slam, you're right. You're right.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.